So hello everyone. Welcome to our third of four global conversations that are part of the International Education Week at Boston University, where we're celebrating our the university's global engagement. I'm Willis Wong, and as the Vice President and Associate Provost for Global Programs, it's my sincere honor to welcome all of you, as well as our distinguished panel. I want to thank College of Engineering, the Latin American Studies Program, and the Earth and Environment Department, which we are well represented here to talk about converting waste to energy, something that's actually, I have a personal interest in. I actually came from a company before joining here, an MIT spin-out called Molten Metal Technology, and we actually took waste and tried to turn it into useful and productive gases and other energies and productive resources. Quite as successful as we like. And I also want to thank our friends from Santander for sponsoring our Global Conversation Series, as well as their support of other programs on campus, our School of Public Health field programs in particular. So welcome, and without further ado, please.
Hi, my name is Nathan Phillips, and I'll be playing a somewhat unique role of being a participant observer here. So I will be facilitating the discussion that we have today, as well as being part of it. So we'll see how that goes. Just a little bit about my background. I'm a professor in the Department of Earth and Environment, and although I haven't worked directly in the waste to energy, I'm moving in that direction. I'll talk a little bit about my interests there. But I want to introduce the rest of our panel to start off with, and then we'll kind of open it up to a little bit of audience discussion as well. And so I'll start with Jillian Goldfarb, who is in the College of Engineering. And I'm going to ask you to just explain for a couple minutes about what your research interest and experience is in this field. And then we'll move to Rachel Garrett, who is a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard right now, but will be joining us at Boston University in about a month and a half or so as an assistant professor of Earth and Environment here. So we'll start off with some introductory comments, and then we'll take it from there. So, Jillian, yeah, talk about your interests, your research
sure.
in this field.
Well, thank you, everyone, for coming and for having us here today at the Global Programs. My name is Jillian Goldfarb. I am a professor in mechanical engineering and materials science and engineering. My background is in chemical engineering, actually. And my research really focuses on waste to byproduct conversions. We look at biomass in particular, so any type of plant matter, any organic thing that gets thrown out that has potentially energy stored in it, or a material that could be used. Basically, we look at taking the carbon and turning it into something other than CO2. And so I brought a little show and tell for everybody today so you could kind of see what it is that we actually do in my lab. And so as an example, we took pistachio nut shells. So I think everyone would agree that that's a waste. You can't eat them. They're used as pet bed lining and in gardens. So, you know, a potential alternative that we come up with is by different heat and chemical treatments, we can form what's known as an activated carbon, which is essentially what's in your Brita filter to clean water. And at the same time, we can form a bio-oil. So I can definitely pass these around. I would suggest not opening it. The bio-oil is not refined, so it smells a little bit. And we can definitely talk about issues associated with that. So this is a little bit about what kind of physically what we do. Yeah, so send that around.
So I'm Rachel Garrett. I'm going to be in the Earth and Environment Department, and my expertise is mainly in agriculture, and I would argue that agriculture is also waste to energy, because for thousands of years, people have been using livestock waste as inputs into the plant system, the cropping system, and crop waste back into the livestock system as feed. So I kind of consider a lot of the trade-offs of taking wastes off of an agricultural area and using them as a different type of energy, you know, for actual fuel or power generation. And most of my research has been in Latin America. And so I've got some examples from the sugarcane industry in Brazil that we can talk about a little later. And yeah, I think that was a point.
And just to add a little bit more about my own background, I've taken, in my career level of career stage at this point, I've taken to describe my career a little bit like an onion. So at the core of what I do is I study trees and plants and how they process carbon and water. And so CO2 is the feedstock for plants. They do photosynthesis out of the CO2. And so over my career, I've started to think, well, yeah, CO2, it's our biggest global problem, right? It's climate change. And yet, this is a valuable feedstock for CO2, for plants. And we're awash in it in our cities. CO2 is spewing out everywhere. Can we harness that waste? Can we do something productive with that? And working with Kathy Lynch and others, we've thought about some ideas that we might use to harness that waste stream. The other piece of research that I've done recently is to go kind of beyond thinking of the trees in wilderness, to think of trees in the city and urban ecology and even the ecology of cities. And in that work, we've done a look at natural gas systems and pipeline systems and documented lots of leaks of methane from our natural gas pipeline systems. And that got me really thinking, you know, this problem of our urban infrastructure got me thinking, well, you know, there's also, you know, sources of biogas that we can harness from our own waste streams, including our food stocks, and that's called biogas or anaerobic digestion. So I've become very interested in that waste to energy conversion as kind of the solution side to thinking about some of our waste of energy through the leakage of methane. So we're going to have a discussion with the panel. I'll seed it with a couple questions, but we want to involve you in the discussion as well. So, you know, you can just ask questions really any time, and we can kind of just keep it very loose and informal and go to the audience questions. So if anyone has a burning question right now, you can feel free to, you know, ask it.
And I think maybe people shouldn't be afraid to ask clarifying questions about what certain things mean, because I'm sure we're going to throw in some words that don't make sense.
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. And you know, it's funny. We jotted down a few talking points, you know, that we might see the discussion off of. And I was just looking them over, and you know, the things that I came up with. You know, I'm really excited about this, but they were all a bunch of concerns about, you know, waste and stuff. And then, you know, I was reminded that our friends that are supporting this are probably interested in opportunities. And you know, so let's start there. What kind of opportunities are there for waste to energy that we're not really, you know, exploiting and are just sitting there? And so I'll just throw that out to the panelists and to the audience and see where that goes.
I'll let you start.
Oh, gosh.
Lowest hanging fruit, whatever you want to call it. You know, where are the opportunities?
So I think if you ask 10 different engineers what an opportunity in waste conversion to energy, you'd get 20 different answers. There's everything from, you know, what people have heard of anaerobic digestion, basically just means you're taking bugs and breaking stuff down without energy or without putting energy into it to get methane, which you can then burn to create heat and create energy. And I think a lot of people understand that. And then we start moving into the idea of, you know, renewable energies that are like wind and solar, and people seem to have a handle on what that is. But we tend to get to this biomass field, and people start going, what? What's biomass? So maybe start with the definition, I guess, of what that might be. And when we talk about biomass and bioenergy, we're really talking about young energy. Okay, coal is a plant or an animal that's been in the ground for millions of years, that's been compacted, and it's been made really dense. It's a rock. It's a rock you can burn, right? Biomass is the young form of that, right? It's the plant before it's been petrified and rockified over millions of years. So the energy in there is less dense. And one of the reasons that I think you haven't seen a lot of commercialization yet is it's harder to get a usable amount of energy if there isn't as much in it to begin with. You know, it takes 10 times the amount of bamboo to generate the same amount of heat as a piece of coal. So that's a little bit to set the stage about why you, I think, haven't heard and we haven't mainstreamed this kind of stuff yet. But in terms of opportunities, I guess, you know, I'm working with things like heat treatment to get different programs. Professor Uday Paul in our department looks at electrochemical refining, how to get hydrogen. So instead of methane for digestion, he's looking for hydrogen, which hopefully will power your car in the future. It's zero emitting. So I think there's 20 million things you could do with it.
So, there's a lot of opportunities in agricultural area because to date we've just been leaving a lot of the residues of agriculture on the ground and plowing them under or not taking opportunities to use those either as an input into the livestock sector or as an input into fuel generation. And so there's just so many places where that could happen better, and particularly in developing countries, I think, or emerging economies, there's a huge role for that. Sugarcane happens to be one of the areas where this is the most optimal because there's just so much energy stored in sugar compared to something like corn. And even though we have a lot of policies supporting corn residues, using corn residues in biofuels, sugar is actually a much better source of that. And Brazil has done a really good job of integrating that into their economic strategy by creating vehicles that actually take flex fuel, so they can take gasoline or they can take ethanol, fully 100% ethanol. And they have these sugarcane mills that are actually don't require any other outside energy because they're using all of the residues from the sugarcane system of the gas, it's called, to fuel those mills. But then there's all the other countries that produce sugar. India is one of them that don't do that yet. So there's a technology transfer opportunity from places that are doing that really well to all the other. Yeah, sorry.
But wasn't the sugarcane ethanol conversion process for Brazilian automotive industry basically started in the during the dictatorship in like the 70s?
1970s, yeah.
So what's the technology transfer hurdle 40 years in?
So, sorry, the fuel, the vehicles are all there in Brazil. They don't exist in other countries because other countries haven't really invested in that. The technology hurdle would be more at the mill level of having mills that are designed to also, sugarcane mills that are processing the sugarcane, the full thing, and turning that into either sugar, because it all depends on the markets from year to year, month to month, either turning it into sugar or turning it into fuel, but then also using those residues to power the actual mill rather than outside energy. So I think it's more at that larger infrastructural level of transferring that. But then there's also the long-term investment in vehicles in other countries that have this flexibility.
But in terms of infrastructure, Rina's question, that infrastructure happened, 40 years ago. So why isn't India, why aren't other emerging countries taking that technology?
Speaking a little out of turn here, sure. But part of, I think, the issue is that when you have sugarcane or corn or another feedstock, where some of that feedstock is actually calories, and some of that feedstock is in the form of unusable energy, like lignin and the structural components of the stock, there's energy in that stock, but it's not caloric energy that people eat. And so utilizing that energy from like the slash, the corn, the part of the corn that you can't harvest, there's energy there, but right now we haven't anywhere, even in Brazil, hasn't really got to the point where we can actually turn that into really good, useful energy. That's called cellulosic ethanol. It's the part that you're not eating or people aren't eating. And one of the big issues with that is to do it right, you need scale. You can't do a little home cellulosic ethanol thing. You have to have big facilities, and you need supply chains that the whole system's got to be really set up for big, because it doesn't really work right now at small scales. And I think that's part of the barrier. And one of the challenges with biofuels in that regard is that investment and public money. I was in California last year. They're really thinking like you have to go all in on it because you have to invest at scale. It doesn't scale from zero. You have to make them big to start with, and that's a little bit of a risky proposition.
Yeah, but I would just add, I totally, that's all true, and that's a separate issue. But the other thing is just to think about is that even though this has been around for 40 years in Brazil, it's been around because the Brazilian government had the foresight to really prioritize research and development in this area to create a domestic market for these products. And just beyond bioethanol, they did that for agriculture in general and are now reaping the benefits of that 34 years later. So I don't think just because it's been around for a long time doesn't mean that there aren't opportunities. It's just getting the research and development in place to actually enable those things to take off.
That makes me think about when you mentioned ethanol, and I think about U.S. history, the role of the federal government, and the lobbyists mandating a certain percentage of gasoline to include ethanol so that it helps the agricultural, those raising corn, and then your comment about Brazil. What does it take in what's prohibiting, yes, some of the political reasons, but what do we need to do as a world, right? How do we get the world to embrace an effort so that it's not one country maybe doing it or one state that's doing it? How do you, what does it take to get people thinking about it in this context? An easy answer to that and also
you want to answer it?
I'll, since I'm not an expert, I'll try. I think when people object to it, like, why me? Why do I have to do this? They must have feel their self-interest is being violated. And I think you have to sort of understand their argument or as what they think their argument is for preserving their self-interest and defuse it. Smog in China, people marvel at how clear the air was in 1979 when they looked at pictures. And no matter how big a car you or how rich you are in China, you gotta have the same smog. I marvel if when I walk through Manchester, UK, there's these plaques saying, you know, in 1945 you couldn't see across the street because coal and manufacturing was so big. So just say, you're getting rich. Get over this. You're going to pay this in public health. You think it's an economic advantage. It isn't, say, in that case. So I think you have to tune into people's arguments and somehow convince people we're all in it together.
But it's also not very clear what there is to get behind because each biofuel is so different. I mean, across the table, what we're talking about is each something totally different. And each one of those things has different trade-offs and different uncertainties and different ripple effects. And when you talk about something that I'm, was mentioning, sugarcane is not such a big deal, but corn, for example, that's also a food product. And so there's impacts on the total supply available for food versus fuel. But then there's also all of these other complex feedbacks whereby, okay, you support a biofuel, well, then you shift incentives for people to plant more of that, and then they take land out of food crops. And then, that influences the prices of crops globally, and that really negatively impacts people in urban areas. So, there's not one set thing that's sort of a silver bullet, and so I think it's tough to say we should all be behind this.
I think it's incentivizing pocketbooks, and it really comes down to a personal level in many ways. There's a huge literature in economics and in energy economics especially, that looks at people's willingness to pay. There are surveys upon surveys and analysis of it. And in the abstract, people are willing to, they say they're willing to pay more. They're willing to pay up to 10% more in their electricity bill for greener options. Yet when those electricity bills go and when they're given the actual option to do this, they don't check it. And in our economy especially, where it's enterprise-driven, now, the government isn't saying yet, you must have this. Our incentives to do it just aren't there yet. People aren't willing to do it. Companies that are doing it, and it's not that we don't have renewable energy in the U.S. I think that's a bit of a misnomer that we don't have this yet. For example, Anheuser-Busch up in Merrimack, New Hampshire, has an anaerobic digester, and they produce so much extra power from the methane that they're getting from just the barley and hops that they're digesting, they actually sell it back to the grid now. So they've made... their payback period was 3 years less than they thought it was going to be for implementing this process. And, kudos to them for getting it. They were LEED certified, all this kind of stuff. to have that happen. And there are other companies that are doing that. You know, the paper mills up in Maine are looking at ways to reuse the lignin, and they partner with the University of Maine up there all the time to look at ways to get biofuel from lignin, which is not an easy process to handle. So there are these things happening. It's just they're not on a broad level, at least in this country. And then trying to translate that to another country, like, who are we to dictate that China shouldn't use their vast resources of oil shale to generate electricity? They're where we were 40 years ago. They certainly have a right to advance as we did. And, you know, to Brazil, who were, you know, they thought about this ahead of time. They didn't have the fuel supply that we have. Now that natural gas is cheap, no one wants to put money into this. Who here doesn't like paying less on their electricity bill? So there's this disincentive, right, between the public, what they say they want, and what they're willing to pay for. And that's a lot, I think, where it comes from.
Any responses or follow-up? I'll just add that I'm actually really kind of amazed and surprised that in kind of a post-Kyoto world that a lot of action is unilateral. And in the United States, at the state level, even at the city level, and then countries like Germany, really just unilaterally taking off on renewables, biomass, and these kinds of energies. And the recent agreement between the U.S. and China on reductions of emissions, I really wonder how much of that is the race to renewables and the business model for who's, you know, because China is just cranking out the wind and solar. Yes, they are leading the way in carbon emissions as well, but, you know, I see it as, you know, a real race to renewables, and there's an economic and business model that's behind that agreement, I think.
What do you mean by the post-Kyoto world?
Well, Kyoto, I don't know if many people would, if anyone would say that was a success in terms of international agreement, and
it's a clarification question.
The Kyoto Protocol was an international agreement that related to reductions in carbon dioxide emissions internationally. So it involved both developed countries and developing countries in an overall agreement, international agreement framework. And there's been meetings, international meetings, conference of parties meetings after that. And I don't think they've been successful. I don't know a few people. Yes.
Did the U.S. refuse to sign it?
We did not ratify.
Yes.
We
didn't ratify.
That's right. So
there's not even consensus on no-brainer of a set of protocols to agree on, yet this country didn't even ratify it.
Yeah.
And so, again, coming back to Jillian's point, you know, just that how does this happen? And it is just amazing to me to see that at kind of lower levels of governance is where most of the action is actually happening. And with the case of Germany, for example, that country alone has contributed to driving down the price of solar and wind just by the volume of, that they're purchasing and the manufacturing. In a place like California, biggest state in the union with its low carbon fuel standard, that is something which implemented at the state level can really, you know, spill outside of the borders and drive the market for low carbon fuels.
There was a question.
Just curious what you thought the leading obstacle was. Is it more the technology side where, you know, whether it's obviously all processes have some sort of byproduct, what to do with those items? Is it the division between the fact that there's so many different obstacles? Which avenue do you pursue? Is it the financial and political side? What do you think is, the leading obstacle that we need to overcome first?
I mean, I think some of the obstacles are overcoming themselves in the sense of the market. It's becoming more and more expensive to dispose of waste and not utilize it. So it's becoming more advantageous to actually find a way to use that. And all of these other inputs, if we go back to the agricultural example, all of the other synthetic inputs that we're utilizing in the system are becoming more and more expensive, often are tied to fossil fuel markets. So synthetic nitrogen is becoming more and more expensive. So if we're missing these opportunities to utilize these now increasingly competitive you know, waste sources that are right there and will eventually be cheaper. You know, I just think that the market is making that trade-off less daunting. And,
I definitely, I agree. I think it's a market issue in many ways, at least in this country. Gas is cheap. I remember when I was a grad student, I was paying $4.54 a gallon. Like, you didn't just randomly decide to drive, you know, somewhere and have dinner. Like, you know, that was expensive on that budget. But now gas, I paid $2.97 out in Waltham the other night. $2.97 a gallon. That is insanely inexpensive. You know, for anyone who travels and drives in Europe, that's about, what, half the cost now? 50%?
I think it's less.
It may even be less.
Three or four times.
Yeah.
In India as well.
There's a reason why we all drive tanks and, you know, we're not pushing for these things. You know, in California, I think Nathan's example was perfect about legislation driving innovation, in that in California, they set these strict air quality emission standards. They had to because of the smog. That drove car makers to have to put catalytic converters and learn how to make them cheaper. Now, the fleet of vehicles across the country all has the same catalytic converter. They're all partial zero emissions vehicles because it became too expensive to manufacture separate cars for California and then retrofit them. So we're kind of in this tug of war right now where the science isn't quite there. And every time gas goes cheap, we stop investing in the science. Or every time, you know, the balance of power shifts, we stop investing in something else. So there's this, you know, this break between what the policy and the, you know, economicists have told us about what we need to do, what the scientists and engineers have said what we need to do, and what the public and politicians can make happen. And I think it's almost more a breakdown there than it is ability to get to the point.
So I have a question actually for you guys, because one of the things that's happened in agriculture over the last 40 years is that research and development used to be a predominantly public issue, and most of the money was coming from public sources, and now most of the money is coming from private sources. So it's tough to take a long-term time frame, you know, when you're basically focusing on your bottom line of your company over the next 5 years, let's say. So has that same shift happened in the sectors that you guys are working in, and or is public investment still playing an important role?
It's probably both, actually. Yeah. It's a great question. Because, I mean, we're funded a lot of the times. I mean, my biofuel projects is funded by NSF, you know, National Science Foundation. That's a publicly funded enterprise. But at the same time, the government programs now are putting their own restrictions. The production tax credit, which was given to companies to encourage them to develop renewable fuels, to get source renewable energy, started in the 90s. And companies started investing. They were going for solar, they were going for wind, because they would get cents off per kilowatt if they bought from renewables. Congress failed to reauthorize that in January of this past year, and all of a sudden companies are like, oh, who cares, we don't get that anymore, it's not worth it. So now even the public has put time limits on this kind of stuff, and every time you stop investing, you stop a cycle of growth, and then it takes that much longer to catch up on research.
Yeah, I saw a statistic or a graph just recently that public funding for energy research has just been shrinking, you know, over the last few years, and I'm seeing it in NSF. I think Jillian is just one of our star researchers getting the NSF funding there, and it is getting harder and harder and more competitive. I think we all know that in terms of the funding rates for federal funding and support on energy research. So very difficult. Yeah.
Who funds the research, the document?
I think that's actually self-supported NSF. Like NSF reporting is required to detail that.
I was thinking more of how, you know, in countries you have national agricultural institutes, and you also have international bodies like CGIAR, Consultative Group and International Agricultural Research, and their budgets have just shrank in so much.
But when that doesn't make sense, there might be a political. And then, if it is not, if it contradicts somebody's self-interest, is that an opportunity to go to some foundation gate or whatever, and just get common sense going somewhere, even if it's not here?
Yeah, I guess I was thinking in a different context of you guys, which was, yeah, more, I wasn't talking about me as a personal, as a person getting research. I'm talking about national, the departments of agriculture, national research centers, where the money has to be coming from their own government to actually support the future of agriculture in that country. So it's not like they can just go to a foundation to offset government support. I think it's a little bit different in us as researchers and what we do. So,
Sure. I mean, we do have that kind of thing. I mean, we have National Renewable Energy Lab, NREL, out in Colorado. You know, a lot of the national labs do this kind of research, you know, and it's not that you're not funding it. You're just funding less of it. Thanks, Congress.
Yeah. But I think that that's one of the reasons why this is a great conversation, because we do need to start thinking a whole lot more serious about diversifying our funding to include private and foundation and nonprofit funding models. Absolutely. In fact, when you think about the rollout of renewable energy systems like microgrids and distributed solar in the developing world, it's largely funded from nonprofits and smaller organizations than your big World Bank and other large development types of entities. So, yeah.
But it's challenging. So I worked for a technology company in the 90s, and we had gone public. We also had raised a lot of private funding. But a large source of our revenue came from the Department of Energy, and the cost of the technology was too high. There was a lot of competition. And I think about solar, right? And I can't remember the name of the company. They opened up a big plant out in Solyndra, I think it might have been, and there they received a lot of federal funding, but also private investments, but they eventually, I think, lost out on the market because China undercut the prices. So you got multiple pressure points, and if you're talking about more private funding, depending on who they are, if they're venture capitalists, there'll be a heavy pressure on return on investment by their investors. And so which is the right technology to find the spot where you can get to market quickly, so your funders, you know, get some value quickly. That ideally buys you more time, so you can do the longer range research on something that will take longer. That's going to be a challenge.
Deep. Let's say you had a point.
So I was coming back to, you know, the topic is waste to energy. So are there different sources of waste? Can one say, is it, you know, biofuels, biomass? Would you consider wind and solar waste to energy? Is wind and solar in there? And can you say, like, what's the most efficient and least expensive one? Or is that scientists haven't, you know?
I like this question because it really is a clarifying question about, you know, basically what are we talking about here? What constitutes waste and what doesn't, you know? And so that's a really great question. So.
So I would look around personally, and I would say 90% of this room, in all likelihood, maybe even higher, could be made into energy. It's all energy. It's all, anything to me that's energy is carbon-based. It's made of carbon molecules, okay? The definition of something, by the way, that's organic, it's not that it was grown in a certain way. The chemical definition of organic is that it's made from carbon. Okay.
So what's not?
So this is not made from carbon. Well, that's plastic, so that's carbon. This is carbon.
But we can add some of this clarification to the waste part. I think it's waste when it's an outcome of something, some other economic activity that we're doing, but that we're actually paying often to dispose of it. You know, I mean, that's a kind of conservative definition. But you can think about how illogical it is to pay to dispose of something that you can then use actually as an input to reduce your costs of buying something else. So, I mean, if we put that sort of boundary around it, I think we still can cover all the things we're talking about.
So
but
not solar, not waste.
I wouldn't think of that.
I think of those as wasted opportunities.
Yeah. But we're also not paying to, like, store the sun somewhere else. Yeah. You know,
So those would fall under renewable, certainly. Yeah. And just as a quick, like, gauge of what we know, in the last Energy Information Administration plot, about 3.5% of our electricity in this country, 3.5% was renewable. that is defined to include solar, wind, biomass, anything like that. Hydrothermal is a little separate. That's like another 2%. But yeah, 3.5% in this country is renewable. Yeah.
That's it. That's it.
I mean, is anyone else going, what?
Yeah.
Really? I mean, there's bio oil right there. So there's, I know, I'm all on that.
And is it because, I mean, so Germany, you talked about Germany. So Germany, I'm told, is like 30% of their energy comes from solar.
Or renewables.
Or renewables.
As well as biomass.
Solar and wind, right?
Yeah.
And there's no sun.
So that's a problem.
No sun in Germany,
in fact, they're actually buying a lot of their power from France right now, and France is almost entirely nuclear. Which nuclear is in some sense a renewable fuel. You can regenerate nuclear fuel. We know how to do that. It's a net zero process. Obviously, building the plant is not net zero carbon emissions, but you got to build something somewhere. So yeah, Germany gets quite a bit of their power from France.
You know, I would say that they're on a very aggressive plan to go fossil free by the year 2050, and they have to make tough choices to get there because grid stability, has to be there, and so they've been using coal to gap fill, but they do have a plan to really keep driving on the renewables, and I think Munich is on track to go 100% fossil free by, I believe it's 2025. Burlington, Vermont has gone fossil free now, I think. This is doable, and it's doable in the time frame that we absolutely need to have. One other thing that really excites me about biogas and here is that one of the criticisms of renewables has been their intermittency. You know, the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. If you can generate storable, renewable chemical energy at the same place where you're consuming it, your waste stream, you know, locally, it has an outsized impact because it can be used to gap fill. So biogas that's generated from waste, even if it makes only 5% of our, you know, usage, if you deploy it when you need it to run, you know, electricity generators, keep the grid going, it has an enormously larger impact than just its, you know, kilowatt hour equivalent.
So yeah, just reminding me of another point I generally wanted to make during this entire panel was that we're talking about these things sort of at the global level, but I think that there's an additional opportunity in terms of rural development and places where people just don't have access to energy, which is a billion people globally, and we should also be thinking about the opportunities for decentralized waste to energy, where the benefits to actual well-being are just disproportionately large because they're disconnected from these other power sources. So, I mean, I don't know if people have questions in that area, but
that's an interesting point, right? Because you really talk about an opportunity that is interdisciplinary in terms of changing how people think along with the use of certain technologies. So, if you're looking at some rural part of the world where they're not, whatever the culture norms are, there's getting someone to use human waste or something like that, but with the technology, you have huge hurdles, and it's really a social economic hurdle than maybe a technological
one. Or they're using waste every day, but they're using it in their way that's actually polluting their air, and they're breathing it in as they're cooking. So, you know, it's a combination of getting them out of that system, but also providing a system that can replace that source of energy, which again comes back to this discussion of long-term research and development and in actual technologies that are affordable. And so I think it's all that.
What are the opportunities in a landfill? Like, I have a kid at home with diapers, bottles. Like, what in there can be used to generate energy?
You're the expert on that.
In a crude way of saying it, stick a straw in it. If you imagine you literally drill down through the landfill, as the landfill ages, it starts decomposing. And all that is forming this biogas. The biogas is predominantly methane. CH4. You burn it. It's highly a clean fuel to burn. I mean, if you want to talk about not having to scrub an emission, it's awesome. So you literally drill down and you tap the gas and you pump the gas out. Now, part of the issue is that this gas can be a little dirty. It can have some sulfur in it, some heavy metals. So you do have to refine it. It is not actually a difficult thing to do. In fact, University of New Hampshire tapped the Rochester landfill 12 miles from campus, pipes the methane to campus, and they have their own cogen plant. It's so efficient, it powers all of campus, so they barely take anything from the public service grid, and they're using waste heat, and they're pumping it across every sidewalk around campus, so they never actually have to shovel or de-ice sidewalks anymore. So there are things that we could do that right now. The capital investment for that is high, and people aren't willing to do that because they don't know how to integrate it to the grid, and there are just all these questions. The technology, I think even for a lot of the rural development, I've worked with Engineers Without Border groups doing this, we have a lot of this technology. We do know how to do this. We're not in the Stone Age for it, but we keep encountering socioeconomic issues. For example, in Africa, where one of my student groups was working, the equipment kept getting stolen. People were stealing the generators to sell them on the black market because they needed food. And that's how they were feeding their families. So the Engineers Without Borders that would raise the money, go down, build everything, and 6 months later it was gone. So we have a much bigger issue than just knowing how to input the technology. It is a global issue and it's a cultural issue, and we have to be aware of that.
One of the questions I have is one of the different constituents that are involved in this and the different motivations that these different constituents have. I'm curious to know what's happening to bring these different constituents together. You just mentioned the difference between having it at the global level versus having it at the city level. What's happening to bring these different people together? Because ultimately, it does come down to someone's got to pay for it somewhere. Right? Even if there's benefit at the end, someone's got to pay for it. So what's happening to bring these conversations together?
I think that that someone has to pay for it is a really, that's a very important point. And I think that, if business models can develop where it's profitable, to see waste as profit rather than something that we have to deal with, we have to pay for and get rid of, to flip it and think of it as profit, that's a key. I think it's a mindset. One of the biggest barriers, when we were talking about barriers, I think is the mindset of waste where it's worthless. Instead of, it is a feedstock. Every waste product is a feedstock for something else. And in Northern Europe, they pump greenhouses with CO2 because they know that the produce grows much faster when they are feeding it CO2. And as I mentioned, we are just awash in that valuable feedstock. It's our biggest global problem, but it's coming out of our tailpipes, it's coming out of our buildings, and we could be using that waste stream to grow things, for example.
It's interesting that you said, I think, in some of the companies that we've been talking to, I think that's it exactly. How do we flip that conversation from who's going to pay for it as to either who's going to save from it or who's going to profit from it? Mm-hmm. From the conversations we've had about waste management is that waste is not only an energy source, it's also it's a byproduct, but it's selling.
Oh, it's a commodity.
Yeah. It's a commodity. Yes. Yeah, that's what
definitely.
It's a commodity. One set of waste is someone else's raw product for the next. Changing that supply chain kind of conversation.
And isn't that something everyone can get behind? I mean, there's really nowhere on the political spectrum that I think anyone could really, have a...
Well, I think some people will find something.
Well, let's hear. What? Who?
No, but I'm glad you brought that up because I was actually going to say as you were talking that I think there's a lot of possibility with the move towards international governments, towards sustainable supply chains and private governance. Because in, they're still quite niche, but like certifications and, quality standards and traceability and all these things, there's moratoria in some places you can't use that. You can't supply from here. this whole suite of supply chain governance tools is a way that that supply chains can have some control over what's in what they're getting, but then they can use that as a corporate social responsibility branding opportunity to increase market share versus some other company. So I think they have this unique ability to be able to have an influence all the way down in a specific village by influencing the rules of what people can do there and the technologies. They can also directly invest in technologies there, but then they can actually gain from that at a much larger scale by being able to say, you know, my supply chain is 60% fossil fuel free or whatever. You know, the way they're saying it in my field is they're, you know, 80% deforestation free or whatever. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll get there over time. And I think that's a big opportunity. We just need to be like really diligent about actually studying what it is that they're doing and whether that's actually beneficial. And then the only other thing I just wanted to say is about waste becoming commodities is I just got back from California and we were talking about integrated crop livestock systems. And this is again in the agriculture, but everything's a commodity there.
Yeah.
Every single residue, I mean, pistachios, I'd be surprised if they're not actually already using it at like Harris Ranch, because they're using, I don't know if you guys know Harris Ranch, it's the major beef producer in the United States. They're the massive, massive beef producer. But everybody just thinks of just corn going into that system, but actually they're taking cotton seed and rice hulls and almond hulls and all these mm-hmm. other things, and they're commodities. People sell them and they buy them as an input. So
yeah. I think to your point exactly, that's what happened in the early 90s in California.
Yeah.
I mean, huge power issues, right? The grid could not supply the demand. So the state offered incentives to build renewable co-firing or firing facilities, meaning they're burning biomass. We didn't have the technology yet to do bio-oil. They're burning biomass to generate heat, to generate steam, to turn a turbine, to give us electricity. Brilliant. You're going to take waste out of landfills that would otherwise generate methane that you didn't know how to tap at that point and create electricity. What happened? Well, the carting fees got switched around. So now people were paying carting companies to take their waste, and the carting companies were selling it at astronomical rates to these small power generators who could get the tax incentives for not burning fossil fuels and supply the grid at a crazy electricity rate. So you just had this insane electricity market inflation that happened at this microcosm level around Los Angeles. So the problem is that when everything becomes a commodity, everything's going to go, you know, there has to be a sanity check as to what we're deciding to use when.
I have a question. You mentioned they were burning biomass versus burning bio-oil. Could you talk just very briefly about what the benefit of, you know, the cost of refining it into the oil must offset some of the...
Sure.
So what are the, you know, just very quickly, what are the benefits of
burning
oil versus
The real issue in this country over the next 20, 30 years is not energy for electricity. We have more natural gas and more coal to supply this country that it is not going to be economically feasible to generate, to really move that 3.5% much further than it is right now. No one's going to pay for it. We're just not going to do it. So where a lot of the government money is going right now is for liquid fuels, for drop-in for cars, things that can be generated off-site in rural areas to make a fuel and not have to ship it across the country for refining. So if you just need to generate electricity, throw it in a boiler. Like, these things burn fairly cleanly. They don't burn at as high of a temperature, which is a bit of an issue because it means your process. Any biomass, any crop residue, anything that has that is carbon-based, you can burn. It will burn differently depending on what it is. Like a coal will burn at a lot hotter temperature because it has, like you were saying, this really energy-dense structure. Corn residue is going to burn at a much lower temperature. It's much more reactive. It burns quickly. Right? You think about that in your fireplace. You start a fire with kindling, and then you put logs in, or you start it with newspaper. But the problem is when you have a small electricity generation, it is much cheaper and faster to just burn things. And that's where your CO2 comes from.
What are the emissions?
The life cycle analysis people would say that it's still better than burning coal, because no matter what, if you burn something that is carbon, you will form CO2, right? Like by definition, you put some kind of carbon together and some oxygen from air, you form CO2. the life cycle analysis people would argue that instead of having to dig the coal, which is very environmentally ridiculous in some ways, having to cart the coal, which uses fossil fuels to get it to your plant, and then burn the coal, you're better off just releasing the same quantity about of CO2 from a biomass that you didn't have to dig up than the coal. We're not at the point yet where we have carbon sequestration that is, I don't know, feasible on a large scale. So that's the problem. Yeah, I mean, when we say the carbon economy, that's what it is.
But you're saying that by refining it into the oil instead, that's more usable for the vehicle.
Yeah.
So
that's the end goal, according to Department of Energy and Department of Defense. That's what they want.
Sarah.
I was just going to ask your thoughts on incineration. We've talked about burned biomass, but instead of sending anything to landfill, some countries, I think Scandinavia, Sweden, has a lot of just incinerate all carbon-based trash, and you have to have scrubbers and things to take the pollutants out. But just your thoughts on whether that's any better in the long run than like landfill, or is that something we should be doing as well? Because it's another just burn everything and use that to create electricity.
Sort of
similar waste issue. Is it better or not?
So one thing, this is totally not scientific at all, but I just remember I did my master's in New York City, and I just remember one of my teachers telling me that if you ever have kids, don't let them play in Central Park, because that soil is holding all of those toxins from back when we did used to just burn everything. All the trash in New York used to be burned and then redeposited, all those materials coming out of it were redeposited in our soils. So, I mean, I think just from that standpoint, you know, we need to be careful about all of the non-energy, non-carbon things that are in there.
But that's obviously had scrubbers on to stop any of those pollutants leaving.
Yeah. For sure. I just think it's the cost of those. Yeah.
Yeah. The definition of any. I'd want to be really careful about that. You know, I mean, I know, isn't there an incinerator in Marlboro? So, you know, 20 miles down.
Boston University used to have a big incinerator on the because of the Title V and the Clean Air Act. We, as an institution, made a decision to scrap that. It wasn't worth it. And it also needed some upgrades. So there's some real financial.
And
I think Sweden taking trash from other European countries and incinerating it.
Wow.
How they get a lot of power.
Yeah. I mean, it's a material balance question, right? It's the fundamental core engineering principle. You've generated it somehow. I've now used a plastic bottle, much to my dismay. And I now have to deal with it. Whether I choose to incinerate it or degrade it in a landfill or pyrolyze it to make bio oil, I'm still having to deal with the carbon within this. The argument in today's kind of science climate is that the intermediate steps between this and CO2 are what are going to change the environmental outlook. Do you use this as a fuel before it becomes CO2?
I think it's kind of I think of it as an entropy issue as well, because waste, when it's all mixed up and you don't know what's in it, then your scrubbers are going to have to protect against every possible thing that could be in it. But if you have waste streams that are, you have some quality control on, you know, it's all going to be those bottles, or it's all going to be leaves, you know, and branches, then you're in a much better situation to be able to deal with it with more targeted types of scrubbers and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and, you know, you're just using some, like, food waste. You don't need scrubbers. You just need worms. You know, so I mean, they're able to break that down very quickly into something usable. So I just would wonder at the efficiency of putting in things that are easily, decomposable in with stuff that takes hundreds of years.
And then there's, you know, an environmental justice issue as well, which is, you know, it can sound really great, but where's it going? Yeah. You know, I live in Newton.
Not in my backyard.
There's so much NIMBYism on stuff like that. It's crazy.
What are the implications, for example, what you just talked about? If we finally get to a place where we're able to generate energy from waste, sort of on a macro level, does that kind of give people more of an incentive to be not so judicious in how much they use? And then are we just back?
So that you great actually point. Saw that spike right after the recycling laws went into place and a bunch of other things where people suddenly used more. It peaked back down pretty quickly. And that's an economic, you know, issue. Most people can't afford to keep using more. And I think one of the ways that'll keep that in check is it's going to be more expensive. You know, the cost of this bottle is going to go up. It goes up every year. So I don't know that it's going to be feasible for people to use more.
Or even if they use more, if they're using more of something with a lower carbon impact, does it really matter? I mean, I think it's a great point. But if we get to the point where
we used to use energy consumption as a measure of economic success. So my question is, we're thinking of sequestering carbon. Why not just make a real distinction of taking carbon out of the ground? And if you burn stuff, you're not taking carbon out of the ground. And if it's circulating through the environment, who cares? As long as, and you don't have to worry about putting it into the ground because you're not taking it out of the ground in the first place. If you're burning oil and all that stuff, that seems to be a real problem if you're fracking.
Yeah, you're talking about a biogenic cycle of carbon rather than what we might call a thermogenic or a deep fossil cycle of carbon. And I think the only nuance I would add to that you know, it is the land use impacts, the land use changes that, you know, you can start to clear more and more land to in that biogenic cycle. So it's not really a cycle. It can be out of balance and not in a steady state where just, you know,
you've got a lot more trees.
Yeah, getting to a steady state cycle where the uptake of carbon is equivalent to the emissions of carbon, you know, is, I think, a very important consideration.
But I definitely didn't want to downplay your comment. I mean, the rebound effects on behavior when you change the price of anything are really important. And I think just with any of these things, one of the places we're lacking scientifically is being able to model economy-wide impacts. If you change something here, how will that influence somebody's behavior there? But then how will that influence the prices of other things, and how will that influence people's behavior? So we should always keep that in the back of our mind, definitely.
But I guess it sounds to me that, you know, a lot of what we talk about is that scalable piece. And you talked a little bit about the sugarcane and how that really has to be large scale for those mills to work. I guess I'd like to understand a little bit more about the process itself to see, you know, obviously, you know, it even talks to the economical side of it. You know, scalable, smaller scale models can prove themselves faster than obviously something that requires a larger investment. Do you see any of these being a scalable option where we can kind of earn that traction along the way?
Well, yeah, and I mean, we're doing it now. I don't want anyone to get the opinion like this is like this bleak thing that's not happening. We are. There's a company down, started in Massachusetts, Juul Energy. They're doing a pilot plant right now with a coal-fired power plant, a coal natural gas-fired power plant in Texas, where the CO2 that is captured from the power plant is the feed stream for algae. So there's an algae farm literally on site, and they're feeding the algae with the excess CO2. Now, it's not a perfect capture, of course. And then they're getting bio oil out of the algae. And this is pilot scale in the sense that they're powering towns. Like, it's not, you know, like, we're talking thousands of people here. And then, you know, there are lots of examples of those kind of things. But you're right, the scale, it is a matter of scale. And where we are right now is the technology is at the point where we can do that type of pilot scale work. We can't do across the board the country, but no one's going to pay for it anyway.
I also just think, even the examples I was giving in Brazil with sugar, they're not actually that big. And so, yeah, I wouldn't even think of those as really big. I think you were talking about cellulosic. It's
yes.
A different issue. But I think one of the things that hasn't really come up in this talk is that the original biofuels policies in the U.S. were posed as a rural development, a rural revitalization strategy, because, you know, as agricultural prices have actually gone down over time in real terms, and so rural communities have been suffering, and so I think if we think about some of the smaller scale applications of this, it's really positive, and not just in terms of environmental impacts, but thinking about generating jobs and energy locally, and those small-scale applications are, and you can also make them more flexible technologies where somebody's using something, you know, partially for one use and partially for another use in these sort of more decentralized areas.
Good. I think we've actually gone over time.
Okay.
So anyway, it's been a wonderful conversation. I want to thank our other panelists. So
thank you.